Welcome to the Mozilla Digital Memory Bank podcast, a production of the Center for History and New Media. I'm Ken Albers, and this week we will hear excerpts from an oral history interview with Mozilla Director of Engineering, Chris Hoffman, recorded in March of 2006 by Olivia Ryan and Tom Scheinfeld. As a veteran from the days at Netscape, Chris had some very interesting commentary on the historical path of the Mozilla development community. The entire interview is available for download at mozillamemory.org, an interactive archive you can help build. Early in the interview, Chris talked about how he came to work for Mozilla and the process of open sourcing the Netscape code.
Tell us what you do here at Mozilla and how you came to work here.
So I was the first employee hired by the Mozilla Foundation and built out the small engineering and support staff that we had in the first 18 months. We had about a staff of about 10 people. Prior to that, I was at Netscape. I worked at Netscape and have worked on browsers for about 10 years now. It was part of the effort to take the Netscape source code and put it into open source and start to to create a developer community and kind of get the Mozilla project off the ground. That was kind of an interesting experiment. That was the first time a commercial company took its intellectual property and source code and put it out to the public. And Netscape saw that as the only way that they could compete with Microsoft in the long term. This was the middle of the browser wars in 97, where Microsoft had thousands of people working on the browser code. Netscape could afford to support a couple of hundred people, and so there was no way that they thought that they could compete over the long run to make a competitive product. And so this was a strategy to engage the open source community to help build browser software. And the idea was Netscape would harvest some of that, turn it into products, and still be able to continue to ship the Netscape browser. So it was an interesting challenge. The first kind of impression that a lot of developers had when they saw all of the code that Netscape put out into open source was a lot of confusion. It was a code base of several millions of lines of code. And it was developed under very competitive and time pressure. And so trying to understand the code was often very difficult. Netscape ramped up from the same kind of, 10 people working, and the company grew to, over 4,000 in just a year or two. And so integrating all those people, making them productive, helping, in building products, led to, rapid growth of the code and kind of spaghetti development process where there were lots of ideas about how browsers should work and trying to inject them. And then competing with Microsoft, almost a day-to-day release comparisons, who's doing what, who's adding new tags, what features are going in. And there was lots of visibility in the press, and it was, each company was under this, constant. So the code was actually not in very good shape, and the open source developers that tried to get engaged with the project kind of immediately recognized this. Browser code is going to be hard. It's a difficult technical challenge to build a browser when you think about it. You've got, currently you've got over 10 billion web pages out there, and that's all the input for a browser. And so a browser being able to take all of these very diverse inputs and then through the internet, through all this technology of, routers and hubs and networking configurations, being able to take that and then trying to create a user interface that makes that harnesses all that and makes it very simple for a novice user to be able to get to that content and be able to show it on their screen and manipulate it is a pretty tough technical challenge. And so browser software is going to be complex no matter what you do, but all of these competitive pressures kind of multiplied all of those problems. And so once Netscape had put their code into open source, And then the feedback from developers was, this is too complicated, this is too complex. We kind of saw that if the project was ever going to be sustainable over the long term, we had to essentially like start from scratch, start with a new slate, and build the browser engine kind of from engine up all over again. And so that project was started in about 99, I think.
Later, Chris talked about the challenges of moving a commercial product to an open source model and the different development approaches software engineers faced after this change.
It was very interesting being part of this transition from taking a commercial software product like the Netscape browser and putting it into open source. And it was an eye-opening experience for just about everybody that was involved in that. The kinds of things open source software and open disclosure and open development principles have is the very first thing that happens is that there's a whole new perspective on security and quality that gets injected, like the immediate from the moment there was an announcement that Netscape was going to do an open source to the engineering organization. It happened immediately. The engineers, the first thing they said, you can't take my code and put it into open source and have, you know, peers and potential employers, you know, of mine in the future. I don't want them to see this code that I've been working on because it's in such bad shape. It may have not been in bad shape, but that's their perspective. You know, they wanted to be able to clean it up and write better comments and make sure that it worked correctly. That was the impact that it had, you know, immediately. And then the other thing is, well, we know about some security problems that we've got that we haven't gotten around to solve yet. We've got to fix those before we put this, or we'll expose all of our users to these security problems that, you know, no one else has discovered because they haven't had access to the code yet. But as soon as we put it out there, it'll become obvious. You know, they'll read these lines of code, they'll go develop an exploit. So that just the announcement, you know, this was before. Is kind of an eye-opening experience for everybody that worked on it. And, you know, people often, you know, have these concerns. Well, all of the code is open. Don't you think that there's the potential for, you know, for people doing this, reading through, you know, discovering a place where security vulnerabilities? We've crossed that gap. You know, the code has been out there for 10 years. People have had the opportunity to develop exploits. But people have also had the opportunity to do research projects to go find those. You know, we've had, you know, PhDs and professors and graduate students and, you know, junior high school hackers all looking at the code for 10 years. And, you know, we've ground out everything that people can conceive of to protect our users, to build in strong security. So for a company like Microsoft that's got all of their code, you know, behind a firewall and protected, it would be a disaster for them if they put their code into open source at this point, because they, you know, they're at this stage where disclosure of all those things would generate a whole new round of problems for them. But we you know, we crossed this gap and we did it 10 years ago, and so it makes our code stronger, and it raises the quality bar. The other kind of impact that it has is that there's ability to kind of incubate some ideas and thinking in open source still. But as soon as you check in any code to implement any kind of new feature or do anything new, that code shows up in, you know, the source code repository, and it shows up in the you know, nightly releases that we create for testers. And so there's the immediate feedback on anything that you do. Commercial companies can go off and they can incubate things and they can develop it and have it evolve, and then they usually don't get feedback until they do a beta test or, you know, a public beta test, or maybe even until they ship the product. But the thing that this creates is that, like, it makes it very hard for us to get very far off track with what people will accept in the software and trade-offs that we'll make against security or versus new feature development that improve usability. You know, because we have this testing community of 10,000 testers that are downloading our releases every night. You know, we get instant feedback, and if we do go off track, if we do go in a direction that we've got a wide variety of people that will start yelling and screaming, and that'll translate into like press reports that, you know, Mozilla is developing this, you know, this strange feature that could put user privacy at risk. And so we have to immediately kind of factor in all that. A lot of it is, you know, can be noise, but we can summarize and take that feedback to heart and kind of go in and make adjustments if we need to. And that happens a lot faster. Mm-hmm. There's this constant feedback that commercial companies, it's on a longer time period where they get feedback. So there's a lot more that can be invested before you find out how far off track you've gone.
To hear Chris further discuss his work on Mozilla, his thoughts on the importance of the volunteer process and community, and his take on Mozilla's successes, download the full oral history from the interview section of the Mozilla Digital Memory Bank. Thank you for listening this week. We'll be back in 2 weeks with highlights from an interview with Jervis Markham from the Mozilla Foundation. In the meantime, please help us collect the history of Mozilla, both from the developer and user perspective. Visit mozillamemory.org or email us at mozmem@gmail.com. That's mozmem@gmail.com. And become a part of history by contributing your story to the Mozilla Digital Memory Bank.